Go for it, man.
All right, thanks. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Give me a T.
T.
L.
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 T.
T.
S.
S.
What's that spell?
The Linux Night Tech Show is on.
Is on.
Your link to GNU Linux and the latest technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Free software, free speech, open technology,
and open mic.
I love it.
Now, live from the Linux Link Tech Show studios, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away.
Another exciting episode of the Linux Link Tech Show. This is episode 274. November 19, 2008. Welcome, everybody.
Hey. Before we get to our wonderful guest, I have to make a correction. For the past couple of shows, and even on Linux Outlaws, I had erroneously said Slackware does not ship with Apache 2.x. I was wrong. The version 12 of Slackware changed over from the 1.3 series to version 2.0x series. So I stand corrected.
All righty, Dan.
That's all I wanted to say. Now we can get right into our wonderful guest, Pat.
Well, we got a great guest tonight. We've got Paul Frields, who is the Fedora project lead. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. How are you doing?
Very good.
Yeah, I was going to say, 274 shows. I think there are probably, like, marriages that don't last quite that long, really.
No. Well, we're the cockroaches of Linux podcasting, so... After the nuclear fallout, we'll still be here, moving around, producing shows.
Nice.
So, Paul, we met you at the Ohio Linux Fest, and it was really exciting seeing what you guys are doing. You had a pretty short presence there.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun being there. Yeah, so we had a booth that was, we kind of got this corner spot right next to the Ubuntu guys, and hung out there all day, and got to see a lot of different free software community members, and talked to people about what Fedora was about, and stopped by a bunch of the tables and catch some of the really cool projects. And I was pretty floored. That was my first time at Ohio Linux Fest, and I was amazed at just how many people were there and just how excited they were to be a part of the free software community.
Yeah, OLF is a great show, and we've been going for the last few years, and it seems that like people in other parts of the country are finally getting the clue that it's a really good Linux show, and it's been going for some time now.
Yeah, it was very cool. I actually got to meet up with a bunch of our ambassadors from around the Midwest. A couple guys came in from the West, and I think one or two came from the Southeast part of the country, and so we all kind of picked Ohio Linux Fest as a good place to rendezvous and talk about future plans and just sort of put faces to names. And that's always one of the great parts of this job, the times that I get to travel to events and see some of the people that I only really know by like an IRC nick or an email address. And you get to put a face to a name, and it really reminds you when you're sitting behind your keyboard working, you know, who you're working for and who you're working with.
Now, was there any conflict or fight as you were sitting next to the Ubuntu guys?
Oh gosh, no. It's I didn't feel that at all. I think it was a great time was had by everybody. And I remember at one point Jonah came over. He was trying to get some photo off of his BlackBerry, and came over looking for me. He's like, "Can you pull this off for me? Can you pull this off?" And I tried to get it onto my laptop, and I was cursing at it a little bit because I knew he had had a problem with it, and I was like, "Oh, this would be great if I could actually pull this off and get this photo loaded up somewhere for him." And it didn't work, and I was really disappointed. I was like, man, I'm going to have to talk to those Bluetooth guys and find out what's going on with this. And then I found out that actually it was this crazy model of BlackBerry that he had wouldn't work with pretty much anything that was open source. Somebody whipped out their phone and said, well, I don't know, give mine a try, and everything hooked right up. And so I found him later, and I was like, man, sorry about that. It was this crazy, you know, open source incompatible thing that we ran into. But that was, you know, that's just an example of how people are at these events. You know, in the big picture, we're all out there to get free software out in front of people. Whether it's users or developers or companies, governments, nonprofits, whatever the case may be. You know, we're trying to get it out there and make sure that it's something that can really make things happen for people.
Now, you are the project lead for Fedora, and now I don't think a lot of people know what Fedora is, because it's very a very small project, is it not? I mean, not too many people know Fedora, correct?
Well, no, I actually we're a very large project, and we're the evolution of what was a long time ago. I don't know how long you guys have been using running Linux. But there used to be a product called Red Hat Linux. Right? This was made back in the sort of mid-90s. And at some point, Red Hat looked around and said, we have this product. We've been selling this box set. You can go buy it and you walk into Circuit City or Best Buy or Fry's. You can buy this box set of Linux. $40, and it came with, I think, 30 or 90 days of installation support, something like that. And what they realized is that it was the same bits that they were publishing on the website. Right? Red Hat has been making free software now for over 15 years, and they realized that this product really wasn't getting them where they wanted to go. And so what we realized is that there were sort of two masters we were trying to serve. Right, we had the people who wanted to get the latest and greatest cool stuff quickly, and then you had people who were business users, right? You had the large enterprises, people who were on Wall Street or working in scientific research or working in computer animation, and what they wanted is, a product that you could install and basically get updates and fixes for a long period of time. And what we realized is by splitting those two things apart, you really got the best of both worlds. Now, as for something that was going to move really quickly, we also realized that there wasn't a big future in doing a boxed product that you were going to buy on the shelf, because especially as broadband became more popular and large things on the Internet quickly, you basically end up competing with your own free bits. And besides that, it's a huge amount of work trying to get things like the artwork and the actual production of boxes and media and all those things lined up in enough time to actually ship a fast-moving product quickly. So we went to a community-centric approach, and we looked at some of the people who were already doing some really cool work out there with the original Red Hat Linux product, and there was a project called Fedora.us that was run by a fellow named Warren Tagami at the University of Hawaii, and he had rounded up a community of people who were producing these extra packages for software that didn't come in the box set, but which a lot of people might find really useful. And so we sort of approached him, and after some discussions and some work on getting infrastructure off the ground, we had this thing called the Fedora Project, and it was a way of putting a Linux distribution out on a faster release schedule, but involving the community in that. And we actually started that effort back in around 2000, end of 2002, beginning of 2003. So the first Fedora distribution actually came out, I believe it was in either September or November of 2003. So we've been around for quite a while, and we've got thousands of people in our community, millions of users, and we track all those statistics openly on our wiki. We have information out there on where all these people come from and what we're involved with. So we have a really great partnership of thousands of community members and people who are inside Red Hat as well. So we've got engineers and developers, and of course, everybody knows, if you know anything about Linux, you know who Red Hat is. I mean, it's one of the only places that's formed a really sustainable business model out of free and open source software. So, Fedora by no means is small. I mean, we're actually one of the big distributions out there. I'd say the big three that you're going to find that have some sort of corporate backing behind them are Fedora, OpenSUSE, and Ubuntu. Right, OpenSUSE has Novell, and Ubuntu has Canonical or Mark Shuttleworth's wallet, however people want to look at it. The other distributions that are out there, there's obviously hundreds of others, and you have big ones like Debian, which is pretty much the longest lived one of the longest lived free software communities out there, and we sort of try and emulate Debian's approach to freedom somewhat, but we also try and look at a very rapid pace of development, right? That's something that we're really committed to. And so we tend to release about once every 6 months we have a new release. And in fact, this coming Tuesday, just 6 days from now, we're going to be releasing Fedora 10, our 10th release in 5 years.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks.
What can we expect from Fedora 10?
Lots of cool stuff. One of the things that's really cool about Fedora is that we develop a lot of the features that you find all around the Linux ecosystem. So a lot of people look at features like Network Manager, and they look at a lot of the new interesting things that go into various parts of GNOME or the freedesktop.org, and there's a lot of that that's actually contributed to by people who are working in Fedora. Some folks work for Red Hat, and some of them work as volunteers. And some of the things that we're producing are things like Network Manager. Right, there's a connection sharing feature that's new over the last few months. A guy by the name of Dan Williams, who is a developer on Red Hat's desktop team. And he's added this connection sharing feature that lets you take a laptop into a place where maybe you only have one way of connecting to the internet, maybe there's one wired connection available to the wall, or maybe you happen to have a mobile broadband card, but you have a group of people who want to collaborate in the room with their laptops. So you can actually get on the internet with one connection on one laptop, and then in just a couple mouse clicks and naming your network, you can make a route available to everybody in the room using your laptop's built-in wireless. So everybody in the room can start collaborating, and they can basically use you as a gateway machine with no extra configuration required. So that's one of the features that's in Fedora 10.
Cool. That sounds perfect for conferences.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one of those situations, say you go in a hotel, right, and you've got a bunch of people that are gathered around the same hall, and you go into one of these shyster places where it's like, $15 a night for a broadband connection, and now you can have one guy, or maybe everybody pools their pocket change, and one guy buys the membership, and everybody piles onto it.
Well, what are the big things that I really like, and it's not so much specific just to Fedora, but it's specific to the latest version of GNOME, is Network Manager 0.7 with 3G support. It's very good.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's been built on this there's this really good basis for new features that Dan has built in Network Manager, and that's one of the things that makes it I think it makes it very popular for desktop users, makes it really popular for people who just want easy network solutions. And he's also done a lot to make it very flexible with VPN. There are VPN possibilities. You can do that with OpenVPN or the Cisco client. He's got the ability to alter routing for whatever VPN you're using, and it's completely compatible with your key rings, so you can store the password secrets that you need and have them available by simply logging in and unlocking your account. So all that stuff, Dan has basically built a ton of that stuff into Network Manager. I think that's one of the reasons it's so popular. Another one of the cool features that's coming is in PackageKit. Right? PackageKit is something that we developed. It was done by a guy by the name of Richard Hughes, and he's got actually a pretty sizable cadre of people working with him from a lot of different package management backgrounds. So PackageKit is what you would call like a unifying tool set. It's something that rides over top of whatever kind of package management you have on your system. So it'll work with RPM and Yum. It'll work with Deb packages and apt. It'll work with Smart or Zipper or any number of these different package management systems. One of the reasons for that is twofold. I should say the reasons for that are twofold. Number one, it gives distributions a way to kind of put the same software management tools in front of everybody. So whether you sit down at an Ubuntu or you sit down at a Fedora or a Debian or an OpenSUSE or whatever you're going to sit down at, you're going to have the same package management tools available to you. So there's not this need to learn, a whole different set of options and installation flags or whatever the case may be. You can kind of go for either the console PKCon application, or you can use the graphical tool set and do whatever package management you need to do. So go search for something that you need or install, remove software, and all those things work in a unified way across every distribution. And it's built on freedesktop.org standards, so it's been integrated into GNOME and KDE and who knows how many other toolkits you could build front ends for if you care about those things. So it basically gives people a single unified experience no matter what Linux you're using. And that goes a long way towards improving usability and sort of improving the feel of Linux for people who are new to it, right? If they try out a Linux box at work and then they kind of try one at home, and if they find that they're vastly different, a lot of them get very frustrated. So the more that these tools sort of come together under one umbrella, the easier it is for people to get used to them. And it also kind of eliminates this sort of false, there's a tendency to sort of for people to have these sort of battles or conflicts over, which package manager is best, when really a lot of them are doing very different things under the hood, and so it's like comparing apples to oranges. So rather than spend a lot of time, debating which is better for what use, if you have a unified tool set, it kind of takes people out of that mindset, and then we can kind of all just, share the joy of how great it is that we can just install and remove free software anytime we need it. The second big thing that's really important about PackageKit, and I think people are just starting to come to understand this, is that PackageKit is built over a technology called DBus. Right? And DBus is it's a message bus that runs as part of your desktop. It was developed in the freedesktop.org space. And it's a way for different applications and subsystems to sort of drop messages onto this bus and then at the same time look for messages that are passing over the bus, right? So basically you got people who are, these little applications are talking and listening on this bus at the same time. So what that means is that different parts of the desktop system can see activities that are going on and then react accordingly. Like, for example, you guys might have noticed that, you know, if you're using, and I'm going to stick with a GNOME point of view just simply because that's what I use, but this goes for KDE and it could go for other desktops as well. I'm sure you guys have used GNOME. You've seen, for example, like if your network vanishes, like say your router, you know, ups and dies, and you lose your wireless connection, your Evolution information manager, you know, drops offline. It drops into an offline state. And that's because it's got a little plug-in that has heard a D-bus message from network manager saying, "Oop, I've lost the network." And so Evolution knows that by listening to the bus. So PackageKit is another one of these applications that can listen to this bus as well. And so when somebody interacts with the desktop, it means that PackageKit is going to be the way of the future for giving people way better package support for activities that they want to do. So, for example, one of the things we're introducing in Fedora 10 is this is a codec support capability that PackageKit has. And what that means is if you open up a piece of media that you don't have a codec installed for, PackageKit will know that you've done that because there are some messages that pass across the bus about the particular type of file that you've double-clicked on or single-clicked on, whatever the case may be. And PackageKit will look at the repositories you have configured on your machine, and it'll go search through them for the packages that you need with the codecs to support that media. So it'll, you know, present some dialogues and say, "Hey, do you want me to search for these codecs?" You say yes. It goes out and searches for them and says, "Hey, I can install these packages for you, and that'll give you what you need." You okay it, and, you know, a minute or two later after everything downloads and installs, you know, you're playing your media file, and now you have support for that media without having to know, for example, that you needed some oddly named package like, "Oh, I needed to go install GStreamer plugins Farsight or something like that to get package support for this particular media." So it sort of frees the user from having to think of any of that stuff. Now, what's really cool about this is that that's just the beginning. That's just a stepping stone. There are a lot of other things that we'll be able to do between RPM and PackageKit that are going to enable people to do something like open a document, and if they don't have the fonts installed for that document, PackageKit will be able to go locate those and install them. If you open up a data file for an application you don't have, like say you open up a Scribus file and you don't happen to have Scribus installed, PackageKit will present you a dialog and say, "Hey, it looks like you're trying to open this kind of file and the following applications support it." And, you know, maybe Scribus will be in there. And you would click that and say, "Yeah, great, I want to install it." And then, again, a minute later, you're cruising through your data file that your buddy sent you. So this is something that we can do in the free software world that no proprietary software company can do. Why? Because they're in the business of selling you that software, and we're not. We're in the business of giving it away. So the free software desktop is going to be the place to be, thanks to technologies like that.
Well, that's cool.
I can't tell if everybody just falls asleep.
No. I didn't know if Pat was going to chime in.
The sultry sound of my voice.
But that sounds like a pretty cool set of new. How difficult was it to get PackageKit running? Because I know that we've seen other distributions experiment with their package management software. OpenSUSE is a good example, and it just kind of destroyed their distribution for like three releases. So how difficult was it to get the PackageKit operating properly in Fedora?
Yeah, what's interesting about PackageKit is because it's not, I mean, we're not replacing anything really. It's not replacing RPM or Yum or anything like that. It sort of rides on top. It's like a glue, like an interface glue, which is something that's closer to what makes sense to the user, rather than having to remember a whole bunch of arcane commands or something like that. PackageKit gives you a way of sort of abstracting all that stuff. Now, it still provides a command line interface, so people are, you know, they're totally in the command line, or they want to script something, or whatever the case may be. PackageKit provides all that too. But the GUI tool set is designed not really to replace anything, so we didn't have to rip anything up to put it in. Essentially, all we did was we got rid of one graphical tool that we were using on top and replaced it with another. But since the underneath was, you know, pretty much the exact same thing, although, you know, obviously with some feature enhancements and upgrades from version to version, you know, since that was the same stuff, essentially, you know, most people, all they noticed is, oh, wow, this dialogue looked different. And, you know, the experience was slightly different, but we're, you know, we're guiding people towards what is eventually a far more featureful desktop than what they have now. And, you know, again, the nice thing about this is, you know, these things, although we're developing them in Fedora, and, you know, this is one of the things that we really do, you know, we're a very contributor-centric distribution, right? We have a lot of people involved, and they're all, you know, they're actively involved in whether it's translation or marketing or feature development or packaging or whatever the case might be. You know, we're very contributor-centric, but we try and do everything in complete collaboration with the upstream. Like, we don't use any proprietary software for any of our project. Our entire project is built on the same free software that we are putting out there for other people to use. So we really believe in kind of eating our own dog food. We also, as a corollary, we also try and do everything very, very closely in collaboration with the upstream communities. And so that means that when we develop one of these things, and we, you know, we develop new network manager, we develop a new policy kit or package kit, and we develop, you know, the vert manager that a lot of people are using, we do those as upstream communities, and that way everybody can take advantage of them, because that's really the beauty of open source. It's not about doing something differently and kind of locking it up to where people have to use whatever you're providing. The whole strength of open source is in doing it upstream and providing a way for more people to collaborate together, from put it in front of more people, let them use it, file bugs, get involved in development, or whatever the case might be. So that's really where the power of the model happens. It's not by holding it back. It's by actually putting it out there where everybody can use it.
That's cool. Now, another big thing that a lot of people say with Fedora and appraise Fedora for in the past has been the artwork. Has the artwork attained, you know, remained at that level of quality as in the past, in your opinion?
Yeah, I really believe it has. You know, when we started out, the artwork was basically done by a fellow who worked in Red Hat, a tremendously talented artist named Matthew Garrett, and I think he's also worked on things like the Tango icon set. And there was another fellow by the name of Garrett Liss. I may have just given you the wrong name, and I apologize for that. I'm thinking of one guy and saying another one's name. Garrett Lesage, I think, is the guy whose name I actually wanted to give out there. So he used to produce these really nice little backgrounds. They were simple, and they included a Fedora logo, and you know, they were very peaceful and very enjoyable, nice usable backgrounds. One of the things that we tried to do as we moved into more of a community mindset, as we got into sort of the midpoint of our history, is to try and get more people involved in all of the different collateral communities out there. Right, so people who are writing documentation or doing translations or doing marketing or doing our website design, things like that, right? We wanted to get as many people involved as possible and give them a chance to show their talent and to do something that was going to push the boundary for free software. And artwork was one of the things we looked at and said, you know, we really could build a community around this, because there are a lot of great artists out there doing digital work. And if they knew that they had a place where they could get that work done and have it be seen by, you know, millions of people, you know, most of them jump at the chance. So we, over time, sort of assembled this team of folks, and I think just about everybody on it was volunteers. We had one or two people inside Red Hat, and you know, a lot of folks who were volunteers. And every release, what happens is they go into a process where they put a bunch of designs in a queue. Basically, everybody sort of lays their sketch on the table and says, here's what I'm thinking about for the next release, right? This is an idea that occurred to me. And maybe it's not, you know, fully rendered in digital form. It might just be a pencil sketch, and that's all, you know, all you have to be able to do is put a pencil to paper and scan it in. We may even be able to find artists to, you know, to execute it and turn it into, you know, something digital that we can use in the distribution. So everybody lays these sketches down, and then we look at them, and I say we because I sort of dabble in the art community, not as a real artist, but just as somebody who, you know, really appreciates a lot of what these artists do, and I try and, you know, give them some, you know, some sort of idea of, you know, here's something that I saw might improve this, or, you know, sometimes I say, you know, I look at it and I just, you know, I'm goggle-eyed, and I can't believe that, you know, I know somebody who actually created something like that. So we go through those designs and sort of pick what, you know, by consensus, what people think is really the best design, and then we sort of execute better and better versions of that. And by the time that we get to, you know, a month or so before a preview, a month or so before our final release, we typically have the artwork all decided, and then it becomes a matter of, okay, now we need to turn this into a lot of different forms. So we need to fit this into specific sized banners, it needs to go in the installer, it needs to go on a splash screen, it needs to go in the desktop background, and there's all sorts of ways that we want to use that. So then we start turning it into all those different pieces. And there's a young lady by the name of Maureen Duffy who's been sort of leading the art team, and it's pretty much, you know, she's one of those people who she really leads by example, because she is one of the folks I really look up to her stance, because she very much believes that we can do this kind of great work using entirely free software tools. And there's a lot of people who create digital art for free software, but they're using non-free tools. And one of the precepts that I talked about before is that we try and do everything in Fedora using free software, because it's, you know, we think it's kind of hypocritical for us to put it in front of people and say, hey, this is perfectly great and you can use it, but just don't pay attention to us, because that's not what we're using. And we really try and practice what we preach. So Maureen is one of those folks who has become really practiced with these free software tools, and she teaches sessions at different technical symposia about how to use some of these free tools. We've got people who are using GIMP and Inkscape and a lot of these other free drawing tools, and that's how we produce the final artwork for everything. So at the end of the day, once all that's said and done, we use these free tools, and we always use freely licensed sources. So if we're looking for, you know, in this particular iteration of artwork, we got this beautiful new theme called Solar. And you can probably Google for that. If you look for something like you Google for Fedora 10 Solar, you'll probably wind up on our wiki, and you'll be able to see some snapshots of how the artwork looks. It's sort of this blue sun with flares, and we even have pieces in the boot screen where you can see, you know, if you have specific video cards or if you're using a Visa frame buffer for booting, you know, you'll see this sun down in the corner and these little flares shoot out of it while you're booting, and it's incredibly crazy. So this artwork actually uses all freely licensed sources as well. Like, one of the source files that actually made this solar theme is actually a picture of the moon that's been, you know, completely altered, again, always by free tools, but the original moon shot is a piece of Creative Commons licensed photography. So that way we can freely license it and put it in our distribution because, you know, like everything else, we want the distribution to be completely redistributable. So when we hand you a CD, you know that you are okay to duplicate that and redistribute that no matter where in the world you live. So even in places like the United States, which has, you know, some pretty god-awful laws on how software patents work and the DMCA and all these other things, you know, we've kind of lived down, you know, at the greatest extent of the law so that we can make sure that whatever we give out to people, they can pass on to other people and know that they're okay doing that. So all of this, you know, the licensing of all this work, whether it's artwork or software, you know, all of that matters a lot to the cause of software freedom.
Cool. Now, exactly as a project lead, what do you do for Fedora?
I do a lot of email, a lot of email. You know, honestly, there's a lot of it is that it's about communication, and it's about trying to monitor a lot of the different things that are going on in the project at one time. My predecessor was a guy by the name of Max Spivak, and I'm pretty sure you guys have met him.
Yeah,
I'm sure,
know Max.
Right? Yeah, he's a great guy. So Max sort of described this job one time to me as sort of being the mini CEO of Fedora, right? So the CEO of a company, it doesn't go around cleaning the toilets necessarily, although I'd say that I clean a toilet every once in a while. I tend to stick to the places where I know how the toilets work. If I'm going to clean them, I try and know what I'm holding is like, you know, a scrub brush and a mop as opposed to a chainsaw. There are a couple places where people really do not want me running around in the project trying to do things on my own because I would make a god-awful mess of it. But a lot of it is monitoring what's going on in the project and making sure that all the various pieces are communicating properly with each other, right? That we're running – we run on a sort of a general kind of schedule, and I want to make sure that, for example, the artwork team is getting what they need from the development people, and the marketing folks are getting what they need from documentation. And at the same time as all that's going on, I'm trying to make sure that communication is also flowing from the external project internally to Red Hat as well, right? Because Red Hat's got a staff of hundreds of engineers who do nothing but Linux development. A lot of them work in Fedora part-time, but only a few work in Fedora all the time. So I want to make sure that whenever Fedora is making some change or something important's happening, I want to make sure people in Red Hat know about it. So I do a little bit of – I wouldn't call it evangelizing, because people in Red Hat – this is one of the things that's great about working for this company – is that everybody there is so incredibly passionate about free software. I mean, everybody believes in it. They believe in open source, and they believe in what it means to be an open source company. So I don't have to go around explaining to people how to handle open source. What I do need to do, though, is make sure that when things are happening very quickly, that people internally know about it. And by the same token, if there's something going on in Red Hat that might affect Fedora, I want to make sure that we're letting the community know and that we're planning for it and that we're always giving the community at the greatest extent of power that we can over the distribution, and still making sure that everybody who's involved in it has got a voice and has got the information they need to do good work to advance free software.
So they keep you pretty darn busy, huh?
Yeah, pretty busy. Like, you know, so right now, doing nighttime calls like this, I mean, this isn't unusual. I mean, I'd probably be working now anyway. So this is a real pleasant way to spend my time rather than, you know, drafting yet another press release or writing some white paper for somebody. I get to do this podcast with you guys, so, you know, thanks for having me here.
Now, how did you get in? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, Dan.
I was just going to say, how did you get involved with, how'd you get that position? Were you elected to it? What did you have to do to get it?
Yeah, so, this is kind of, I guess it's kind of interesting. Well, at least it's interesting to me because it's my life, right? So I'm, you know, a very selfish person, egotistical, so obviously it must be very important. The truth of the matter is I've been using Linux for a long time. I was a Linux user for a long time before I was a Linux or a free software contributor, right? First I was a user, then I started to evangelize it to other people around my office. And then later I realized, oh, when this Fedora project thing started back in, 2003, I was like, oh my gosh, this is great. Now I can actually get involved. Because the thing was, I'd been using Linux for a long time at that point, like 6 or 7 years, and suddenly I had a way of returning the favor to a lot of people who had, I felt, given me a free gift, which was this great operating system that enabled me to save money, right? I was actually working in government at the time, so I was actually able to save a tremendous amount of taxpayer money and provide better capabilities than the proprietary software we were buying at the time. And now I had this chance to give back, because during that time, I started evangelizing. I was also teaching a lot of other professionals. So I had a whole career, for several years that was completely based around getting Linux to all the people who could use it and then teaching them how to use it and how to do things with it. So I had this entire career that was based on something that really came to me as a gift. And so when I found that there was this way to give back and I could get involved in the Fedora project, and this is back around 2003, I jumped at that because I'm like, oh my gosh, I've been using this for 6 or 7 years. That's a lot of return I've got on my little investment of time and learning, and all this stuff came free. So heck yeah, I want to get involved, and I want to see if I can do something that'll help other people. So I got involved in the one place I could, which was documentation, because I'm not much of a programmer. I mean, I've done some programming, but honestly, it's not pretty, and it's nothing that I would put up against the people that the people that work on the, for example, the Fedora engineering team, all of whom are really talented programmers, and I just, I can't even run with those guys, at least in that race. So, documentation was the one thing that I could do. I could string two English sentences together passively, and I figured that was a good way for me to do something for other people.
Yeah,
so
oddly enough, documentation is a great way to contribute to Linux, just because we're sorely lacking in that.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's a common problem, and I think everybody fights that, because there's a lot of people who love to get involved in the coding part and they love the using part, but the documentation part is hard. But I got to tell you, after getting involved in documentation, people say, well, anybody can do it. I do think anybody can get involved in writing, but I think there are very, very few people who do it well. And I don't necessarily count myself in that group. Being a good documentation writer is a real skill. I mean, it's like being a good painter or a good novelist or anything like that. I mean, it's just as difficult to do well. There is an art to it. But that doesn't mean that more people can't get involved in providing the raw material, right? Because anybody can write the basis for something good, and then you have editors to come in and clean it up, right? So you find the right people to do the writing, and then you identify a few editors that you can use to turn that, from silver into gold, as it were, right? So anyway, that's one of the ways that I got involved was documentation, and that sort of brought me into contact with these community people. And, but there were a bunch of people there whose email addresses were at redhat.com, and these were the people whose names that I used to see, like, on the kernel commits, or people who were writing tools that I would actually use, where I'd open up a shell script or a wrapper or a package, and it would say this is copyright so and so, and then I'd meet that person at one of the Fedora conferences, and I was floored. I mean, I'll never forget the first time. I'm sure he won't either. The first time I met Dave Jones, who is a longtime kernel hacker, and he's been working for Red Hat for quite a while, and he's one of the top committers, and he works pretty much on the Fedora side of the kernel. And when I went and to this Fedora conference and met Dave there, and people introduced me, I mean, I was like, oh my God, you're the Dave Jones. And he's like, he was a rock star or something like that. And actually, if you meet him, he is kind of a rock star. I mean, he has that look. He's got this, this crazy beard, and he's just like, he just has this really super cool look. And so you think, oh my gosh, this guy really is a rock star. And, it was pretty funny. And I'm sure that, even years later, he'll be like, oh, remember that first time you met me? You were such a dweeb. I'm sure that's probably what occurred to him. So, that was a way to kind of generate a social bond, and that really is what brings people together around free software, is when you get involved with other people and you find out that behind all these bits and bytes, right, there are people who are actually doing this work. And, you know, there are people who love to go out and, you know, have a beer or, you know, whatever their beverage of choice is, or have a hamburger or a veggie burger or whatever the case is. And you can just kind of talk shop and just talk regular stuff. And, you know, you really develop a lot of friendships that way. And that led me into other parts of the project as well. And I started getting involved there. And eventually I got involved in governance when the Fedora board was first set up. And I guess this would be back in about 2006. They asked me to
Now, just get out of here. Just go.
Oops.
Just
talking over.
Leave now.
So,
Alan's really ruining the show.
There's a domestic disturbance going on right now.
Call the police.
So, anyway, this, you know,
rent
show.
The cat is pissing me off now. Get the fuck out of here.
Oh, my goodness. Better wait. Actually, probably 4 months. Maybe not. Well, anyway, so I got involved in the governance around 2006, and I did that for about a year, and I was doing steering committee work, and I had become known to a lot of people in Red Hat, and around the end of 2007, Max called me up, and he basically said, "Look, I'm looking to do something else. I've been doing this job for about 2 years, and you know, I've done I think good work, and I completely agreed. I think Max did a great job as the project leader, and he said I'm looking to try something new, and I need to find a successor before I can move on. I wouldn't feel right unless I found somebody to replace me. And he said, you know, you're at the top of my list, and I would really like you to come work at Red Hat, and take this job." And, you know, it was something that we talked about for a little while, and, you know, I ran it past my wife and made sure things were going to work out well for the family and everything, because I have two little kids at home, so I'm thinking about them and what the future of this job holds. And, you know, eventually I looked at it and I said, you know, really, when you get a big shot in life, when there's a shot that you can take at something, you kind of have to think about it in terms of how much are you going to regret not doing it, right? You don't look at it in terms of what could I lose if I do this. What you really have to look at is in terms of what you would lose if you don't do it, right? And that's almost always going to be the more important calculation that you do. And so to me, I looked at it and said, hey, yeah, I've got a great paying job and it's very stable and that's wonderful and everything, but this is something, if I don't try this, I will kick myself until the end of my life that I didn't take this job. And so that's how I got involved, and I came on board Red Hat in February of 2008. So I've been here about a little over 9 months, and it's just flying by. I cannot believe how fast time goes in this job. It's like every day, it's almost like internet time, right, where every day is like a week, and that really is what this job is like. It's extremely fast-paced, and there's a lot that you have to do, and pretty much more than any human being could possibly do, but, you know, nobody expects you to get it all done. You simply have to be a person who prioritizes well, and that probably helped more than anything else, is just prioritizing and having a good way of organizing what needs to happen first in any given situation.
Yeah, Max did a great job in his tenure leading Fedora. Just looking at it from an outside perspective, it seemed he really got the project on the right foot and pushed it in the right direction. So I guess you want to continue what he was doing previously, but look to improve in different areas. What are some of the areas that you think you can push that maybe Max wasn't pushing as much?
Well, I think there's what Max did, I think, you know, we always sort of pick what are the things that I can realistically do that are going to lower barriers for the community, right? How do we identify the things that are getting in the way and get them out of the picture, right? And what you always kind of look for is, what is the biggest barrier that I actually have a shot at removing? And you know, a lot of the things that Max did, you know, they were really big ticket items. It was things like, you know, getting, kind of removing this whole idea that we had these two software repositories, right? We used to have, Fedora used to be called Fedora Core, right? We got rid of that right after Fedora Core 6. The next release was Fedora 7. And the reason we got rid of that is that there used to be these two software repositories. There was Core and there was Extras. And so Core was where all the Red Hat engineers did their packaging work. And then Extras is where, if you were a volunteer, that's where you did your work. Right, so that it always had this, there was always this whiff, you know, whether it was intentional or not, there was always this whiff of like a caste system, right, where, you know, you can work over in your sandbox, but don't come over in my sandbox. And that's not a great way to promote community. It's one of the things that Max did is sort of remove that barrier. And so now we just have Fedora because the entire software repository is unified. It's one great big universe of like, I think it's something like 10 or 11,000 software packages or something. You know, and more on the way. I can't even tell you how many we have probably that are under review right now. I'm sure it's in the hundreds. And you know, more keep coming all the time. And really it's unifying the repositories kind of led the way to making people feel even better about there being this partnership. So that was an example of like a, you know, it's a barrier that's kind of like right in front of your face and you think, we've got to get rid of this. One of the things that I did early on, when I came on board, I had something that to me was looming. We had this bizarre, contributor license agreement signing procedure, right? And it was something that, there, you know, I understand the legal requirement for it, right? I understand why we need to have a license agreement because we're a U.S.-based entity, and, you know, we're sponsored by Red Hat. Red Hat underwrites a lot of our costs for obvious reasons, right? They do get something out of Fedora, which is, you know, a place to function as an R&D lab, basically. I mean, Fedora is not a beta for their products. We're our own distribution. But it's also an R&D lab where new ideas can be tried that you can't really do with enterprise customers, right? You can't just sort of pop something in front of, the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange, right? You can't just sort of plop something down in their lab and say, here, if it breaks, you get to keep both pieces, right? You can't tell that story to somebody who's buying at that level. But Fedora is more of a distribution where we're very happy to have those things, right? We enjoy playing with those new, you know, whatever's new and shiny. And, you know, if it's a little bit fragile, we look at it as our challenge and our job and our opportunity to kind of improve it. So when I looked at this contributor license agreement, what I saw was that the work that you had to do to get involved in this kind of project, it was way out of line. You had to fill out a web form, and then you had to, like, download this PDF document, and then you had to sign it, and then you'd have to scan it and fax it, or you had to either that or you had to go grab, GNU-PG, right, which is a PGP variant for Linux. You had to grab that, create a key pair, and digitally sign this thing and email it to a certain address. And it was just, it was complete insanity. It was so hard that we were losing a ton of contributors before they ever got to the point of contacting us and saying, hey, here's what I'd like to do, because they couldn't even figure out the steps to actually join the project. I mean, it was crazy. So I looked at that and I said, that is job number one, right? If you want to talk about prioritizing, I mean, that was like a no-brainer. So, you know, I got in talks with the various people involved, the folks who are on our website team and the folks in Red Hat's legal department, and we cobbled out a way to do this in a much better way. And it's, you know, now joining the Fedora project is completely dead simple. If you go to join.fedoraproject.org, you can just click through to make an account. You fill out a form that's pretty much the same kind of form that you would fill out to get mileage points or to, you know, join a social networking site like Facebook or something like that. You simply fill out this form. You click through, and you're finished. And that's it. You're a project member. And now you've got things like you have an email alias that you can use. You can have an SSH account with some public web space on it. You get credentials through OpenID that you can use in other places, and just a variety of other things that come to you as a and also you have a wiki. Immediately you have wiki access and editing privileges. So you can log into the wiki using the same name and password that you just made for yourself, Fedora Wide, and you can start editing the wiki right away. So that we've, because of that, you know, our number of contributors has gone up tremendously. When I came on board, I think we were shy of 2,000 people in the project. I mean, I think it was somewhere around 1,800 or 1,900. And now we've got, I think it's somewhere around 15 or maybe 16,000 contributors. And that's just in the space of, you know, again, in 9 months. So we went in 5 years, you know, took us up to almost 2,000. And then in the next 9 months, we've gone from 2,000 to 15 or 16,000. And the curve is just, you know, exponential. It's incredible. So it's the idea is that you look for those barriers that are most in the way. You identify them, figure out a way of destroying them. And that's pretty much what being the project leader is about. And, you know, and in large part, it's not about me going around and doing all of it personally. You know, one person simply can't do all that work. And, you know, I don't have the skill to do it even if I could do it. It's about talking to people, communicating a vision to them, and finding out the best way to go about achieving it. And a lot of times, I don't have the best idea for achieving it. Someone else does. So you have to listen really well. And obviously you kind of lean on a lot of people who are smarter than you are. And I don't find any problem being in that situation at Red Hat yet.
Well, you talk about using the community. You know, the community is a great resource. People will step up if you give them the chance. And I know it's been a growing process of getting more community involvement in the Fedora project. And what are some of the things that are happening or have happened in the last year or so to improve that?
Yeah, well, so we've got, you could look at, for example, our number of wiki edits, right? There are a lot of things that we measure. In the Fedora project, you know, we take a lot of statistical measurements. We try and pick up metrics on which we can judge how well we're doing at succeeding in certain goals. And then we publish those, right? We put them all on our wiki because, again, that's part of our precept is to do all of this openly and transparently. And, you know, if we're screwing up at something, we're going to publish that too. And then we try and figure out what's going wrong. So if you look at something like, say, our wiki edits, right, and you can see that as we've gone through over time, that is on a huge upward trend, which shows that there are more people involved editing, right? Because it can't be that the existing people are just doing a huge amount more edits because, you know, people's free time doesn't increase that much over the long haul. So you can take that as an accurate measurement, even if it's a general one, of how many people are getting involved. I look at things like our ambassadors, right? We have Fedora ambassadors around the world, different parts of North America, South America, Europe, Asia, etc. And these folks take out of their time to go to trade shows, represent Fedora. They speak at public events. They go to businesses and government offices and nonprofits and schools and colleges and universities and talk about open source, and they talk about the Fedora project and how to get involved. And the number of people who are doing that actively has been doubling basically every year since it started. And I think right now we're somewhere around 600 or more of these ambassadors. And we've got a steering committee that runs the ambassadors that has a pretty good idea of who's active in the project, right? So these ambassadors don't come in, take a title, and then kind of disappear. So, you know, we know that those hundreds of people are all actively working to promote the Fedora project and to promote free software worldwide. we can look at other things like the steady increase in demand for Fedora. You know, we look at how our downloads move from release to release and how they move from week to week, and a number of other statistics, right? So all of these statistics kind of combine to give you an idea of the general health of the community. And I got to agree, I don't know who that was who spoke up just a little bit ago and said that, you know, the community is always amazing in its ability to step up and do things. And that is definitely something that I have, you know, marveled at, even before I took this job. But since taking it, all of that work is so much more visible now, because I actually spend, instead of just a few hours a day, like 2 or 3 hours a day, you know, working in one little part of the project, like I did 3 or 4 years ago, now I'm looking at all the project and I'm doing, you know, I'm looking at it 12, 14, 16 hours a day and seeing all of the work that's going on, across the entire spectrum of what we do, you know, from our translators to our artists and marketeers and documenters and programmers and packagers and our infrastructure team and all the folks who make up the project. So it's pretty amazing when you see what people are capable of doing. I saw a project that one of our folks worked on that I think is going to be a real game changer for free software across the board. He's working on a new translation system that's a very easy web-based interface, and it's incredibly easy to use. And moreover, what it does that's incredibly useful is allows anybody to enter projects into a translation stream and sort of leverage them in a way that's completely upstream friendly. And upstream neutral, and it's extensible in a way that's going to support translation technologies that most of free software doesn't use right now, but that is incredibly useful in other parts of the world and other software communities. So it's, you know, extremely agnostic about that. One of the other things that we talked about is that could be the basis for a very modular framework and a very modular, extensible, and completely free and open source framework for tying together all sorts of different data interchange repositories. So I'm real excited about that. It was something really cool, and it was generated by two guys who basically worked together over the last few months to sort of succeed at a roadmap that they planned out themselves, and as a result, you're going to see, you know, thousands of people using it in the future.
Cool. That's something to be proud of.
Are you guys going to be doing Fedora loco teams?
Well, we have ambassadors. That's something that the ambassador program is something that started a number of years ago, and that's really kind of our counterpart, if you like. I mean, there's ambassadors all over the world. We've got people throughout the U.S. and every geographic region, Europe, Asia, Australia, China, and what we're finding is that the localities, I think essentially we are finding what all of the free software communities out there are finding, which is that the people who are close to the ground in the localities are the people who really carry the message the best to everyone. I try and do that myself, actually, in the limited amount of spare time I have. I also help run the Fredericksburg Linux Users Group, Fredericksburg, Virginia, which is where I live. And so that's sort of my touch point to be an ambassador, and not just a Fedora ambassador, but a really free software advocate. So we had a Software Freedom Day celebration here in Fredericksburg back in September, and it was, you know, probably the first event that was ever held like that here in my little conservative Virginia small town. And I was floored by the number of people who came out to this event. And they were just looking for a way out. They were looking for a way off of the proprietary software train. and said, you know, look, I can't stand having to, you know, whether it's remove viruses or reinstall every month or whatever the case might be, you know, what do you guys have that can help me? And being able to put free software in front of them and say, you know, this is what you want to use, right? You're going to be safe, you're going to be secure, and you're going to be happy because you're not wasting your time. Your computer ought to be your tool, not the other way around. So we were able to put Fedora in the hands of a lot of people, and a lot of other software too, like, you know, the OpenCD, for example, which is a compilation of free software for Microsoft Windows platforms, right? A lot of people aren't ready to switch their operating system, but they are ready to see applications that they can use. And when they find out how good those are, when you tell them a little bit about where they came from, it makes them more open in the future. So, you know, it's not always about converting people. It's about, you know, giving them the right message. And so I try and get involved in that, in giving messages like that at the grassroots level too. You know, so I can have an idea of the kind of things that our ambassadors would see and the kind of people that they would hear from, the kind of responses and the kind of questions that they're getting. You know, I want to make sure that I'm sort of in tune with that. So between all those activities and coming to events like Ohio Linux Fest and whether it's talking to press, talking to folks like you guys at the podcast, I mean, all of those sort of combine to give me a nice round representation of what's happening in the free software community worldwide.
Cool.
So how do you feel about, you know, as a Fedora project leader, how do you feel about the other Red Hat-based projects like CentOS and things like that? What's your take on that?
Yeah, our relationship with them is very friendly. You know, CentOS is a really cool project. I mean, I've met folks on the project. I've met, like, Dag Weirs, for example. You know, and I think we probably shared a drink together last time I was at, when I was at Linux Talk over the summer in Berlin. And the thing that's cool about CentOS is that they're not coming from this antagonistic point of view. People always think that, you know, we look at them, whether it's, you know, we Red Hat or we the Fedora Project sort of look at them as a competitor, and they're not. You know, and Dag will tell you the same thing in his presentations. If you ever get a chance to hear him speak at an event, I would highly recommend that you check it out, because he really makes it clear what the CentOS message is. And, you know, he essentially says right up front, if you're here, you know, thinking that we are competing with, for example, Red Hat Enterprise Linux, you know, you're in the wrong place, because we're not. We wouldn't be here without Red Hat Enterprise Linux, because CentOS, as you guys probably know, is a debranded, rebuilt clone, right? They take the source RPMs that Red Hat publishes for our Enterprise Linux product, and CentOS rebuilds those, and they publish it in, you know, stripped of the trademarks, and they add their own little logo and graphics and stuff, and they publish that as CentOS. Right, the community enterprise operating system. You know, they pretty solidly position themselves as, you know, we're for people who want stability and don't really have the means or desire or need to pay for any sort of support or, you know, professional backing. Right, Red Hat Enterprise Linux. Our value's not in the bits. Red Hat Enterprise Linux, I'm going to, you know, switch hats here. I'll take off the blue hat, right, and I'll put on my red hat now. Red Hat Enterprise Linux, the value is not in the bits. We don't sell you bits. We sell subscriptions, and with the subscriptions come a promise of support. You know, depending on what level you want to buy, there's different levels of support that you can get. We have solutions and training and consulting that we build around the platform, but the value is not in the bits, because you can get those bits anywhere, right? I mean, anybody can get a free distribution. You can get a free as in beer distribution. But what you can't necessarily get is a company, you know, with thousands of employees who have, some of them 10, 15 years of experience in engineering the deepest parts of Linux, right? We've got a whole team of people who do nothing but work on the kernel and device drivers all day. You know, we've got people who do nothing but work on things like iSCSI or NFS or Ethernet drivers or something like that, right? So if you are a company that is relying on Linux to run your mission-critical business applications, you don't want to run something that you can't pick up the phone and get an answer to your question immediately if you need one, right? Because if you can't stand to have your server down for 5 minutes or an hour or whatever the case might be, you need to have somebody at the other end of a phone line. On the other hand, if you're a guy at home and you're just running a vanity web server or project, or maybe you have a couple web server, you know, web instances for friends or something like that, CentOS is a great choice for those kind of people, right? Because I'm not going to go pay for a $400 subscription to Red Hat Enterprise Linux to run Apache and MySQL on an old compact box that I have connected to my router, right? That's not going to happen, and that's not the kind of customers that Red Hat is typically targeted anyway, right? We don't sell onesie twosie to home users. You know, we really concentrate on enterprise class.
CentOS is really complimentary. It's a way for people to get a taste of what Red Hat Enterprise Server is about without costing anything. And maybe if they have a business and they see what it's like and they like it, they can go ahead and purchase a subscription from Red Hat.
I think that statement, there's a lot of truth in that. People, you know, will try that out. They try CentOS and they say, this is what open source is. I think the only drawback to that line of thinking that may bite some people once in a while. And I guess this is kind of a hazard of that kind of strategy is that, you don't know you need support until you need it, right? It's like, the extra key. Like, you didn't know you needed an extra key to your car until you locked the one in the ignition or whatever. That's one way to think about it. But that's kind of a small piece of the puzzle. In the larger sense, what people do, when they look at CentOS is they see the stability, right, and the power that open source gives them, and the flexibility of the platform, and the fact that it opens you up to all of these uses where you don't have to use such a huge amount of hardware, and you don't have to have, a box for every single network function just so you can keep them from dying daily or weekly, right? That you can do a lot with the same amount of hardware. You can do a lot more using free software. So yeah, CentOS in that sense, I think it's a great way for people to see here's what Red Hat Enterprise Linux can provide for me, right? And some people are going to look at it that way. They'll look at it as a business and say, well, I'm going to look at this in terms of risk management, right? I may be the sysadmin saying, I could just buy a CentOS box and that'd be, I could buy some hardware and put CentOS on it and here, I've saved a bunch of money. But if I'm the guy who is sitting in the big chair behind the mahogany desk, I'm not thinking about $400 in savings as much as I am about things like risk management, right? And how I can make sure that our company is protected in the event of something happening. We want to be able to call on the other end, get somebody on the other end of the phone who can help us either build a solution or help us troubleshoot and fix a problem. And that's really where CentOS is kind of like the gateway to RHEL. So, we would hope that there's not a lot of businesses who are, running on CentOS, thinking that it's the same thing, because it's really not. But CentOS is a great way to look at what RHEL offers and to get it for free. Especially if you're a person who, to whom support doesn't matter at all, that's a great choice. I mean, it would be silly for us not to say that because, the technology under the hood is close to identical.
That's true. Do you see, in your opinion, what is the adoption rate of Fedora by desktop users? I mean, are you happy with the progress it's making?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things you have to consider is, you know, where those desktop users come from, right? I talked earlier about some of the really cool features that our desktop team has created, right? Red Hat has invested a huge amount in desktop technologies. A lot of the stuff that people use every day, even if they're not using Fedora, actually came from Fedora contributors, and some of them are Red Hat engineers, right? So I don't look at it as just, you know, if you're using Fedora, you know, you're using, here's the number of desktop users that we have. Because really, our desktop users are everywhere, and they're using, you know, all sorts of Linux distributions. Because those same features, again, it's part of our commitment to working well with upstream, because those features end up in a lot of distributions as a result. That's the end result of that kind of policy. And again, that is the true meaning of the model of open source, is to get those things out in front of everybody. And, you know, whether we do that through a Fedora distribution or not, you know, it's not necessarily secondary, but, you know, it's a little deceiving just to look at numbers. On the other hand, our usage is going steadily upward every year. And we have, in fact, our reach overseas almost seems to be increasing faster than in North America, which is really interesting. It's one of the reasons that we've put a couple people on the ground to help build community around the world, right? So we've got Max moved to the Netherlands, and he is helping our European communities there. We've got a fellow by the name of Harish Pillay who works in the Asia-Pacific region. We have a couple people who are working on the Fedora India program, and the reason we sort of target them specifically is, you know, India is an enormous country that, you know, population-wise, and everyone there knows what the benefits of free software are. So, you know, tapping into that area for contributions just makes complete sense. And we're also seeing a huge uptake in places like China and Russia. Brazil has probably one of the most amazing free software communities ever. They have a real do-it-yourself attitude there, and Fedora is huge in Brazil. So there are a lot of places in the world to consider, and what I see is that our uptake is actually it's exploding worldwide. And it's exploding in a way that is, to me, much more fascinating than just putting a CD in the hand of a user and getting somebody to try the software or put it on their computer. I mean, these are people who are actually chomping at the bit to contribute back to free software. And again, this comes back to what Fedora is all about. You know, it's wonderful to have a lot of users, and we certainly, you know, we wouldn't be anywhere without people actually using the software, but we have always been a distribution and a project that targets contributors, right? We're interested in people who are interested in software freedom, and we are very much consider ourselves partnered with people who want to get involved, right, who actually want to do something for free software. And whether that be, you know, evangelizing it, or whether it's, you know, actually writing code, or somewhere anywhere in between, those are the people that we are really targeting. But because of the fact that we have this huge base of highly skilled technologists, we also provide a huge amount of the features that you see in free software. And I'm talking about everything from the desktop, from things like graphical widgets that you're using, all the way down into the kernel and the libraries that form the stuff that users don't ever really see, but is almost more important than anything else that you do see. There's a page on our wiki that I always encourage people to look at. There's a page on our wiki called Red Hat Contributions, and you can look there and see about the number, the vast array, and the depth of the technologies that Red Hat has invested in over years to make free software what it is today. And so, you know, we're really proud in Fedora that they're, you know, a partner in our distribution and that we have our volunteers. You know, we've got thousands of volunteers who are doing like 90% of the packaging work and most or all of the collateral work around Fedora. And they're sort of partnering with these, you know, hardcore engineers inside Red Hat to do what I think is, you know, the leading edge distribution work that's out there for Linux. And, you know, it's an exciting thing to be a part of.
What's your opinions of Limpus?
Limpus. So this will be the, that's the derivative that comes on. Is it the Aspire?
I believe so.
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah, I haven't tried it myself because I don't have one of those. I don't have one of those little netbooks, those little Acer Aspire ones. You know, it's a Fedora derivative, from what I understand, and I haven't used it. So, you know, my opinion of it is, you know, I think it's great that people build stuff from Fedora. You know, it's one of the things that we've introduced with Fedora 10 is the ability for people to use this secondary MART Fedora remix, so they can indicate where they're getting the basis for some of their software. You know, and it's an optional thing. It's if people want to do it, it's great. But it eliminates the hassle of trying to get things like, you know, a trademark license or things like that. And it gives them a way to sort of say, hey, you know, we actually, you know, we're glad you like what we did. You know, really it's a few guys who are kind of rebuilding a couple things and then adding them to Fedora, right? So if you want to get involved in free software, you're going to do a lot better by going over there, go see the Fedora guys. They'll hook you up with something interesting to do, and that's how you can help advance free software. Right? So this is sort of a tool. It's sort of a tool to get people who want to be contributors to you know, to get themselves into a group that can, you know, sort of leverage their energy.
Now, with regards to Limpus, that's being put together by the Aspire. What is it? Is it a commercial group that's doing it, or I assume so? Yes.
Acer, right? Doesn't Acer
Aspire? Now, do they contribute back to the Fedora project then, or have they? To your knowledge,
I don't know off the top of my head. You know, I would be surprised if they did and I hadn't heard about it. So, you know, again, it's, you know, the ability to use free software, you know, it's not something that we strong arm people with, right? The ability to get involved with our community, we think is a great benefit for people, right? And it helps them not have to sort of rebuild from scratch. It helps them not have to reinvent the wheel. But one of the precepts of free software is that, you know, people are free to use it, and, you know, they don't have to necessarily come join your community as part of it, right? It's something that's a gift. The ability to join a community is a gift. And if you don't want to, you don't have to. You know, as long as you're satisfying things like the licensing requirements, there's really no problem. I mean, That is why free software is a gift and not not an exchange.
Right. Okay.
So, do you guys derive some satisfaction out of the fact that that Linus Torvalds runs Fedora?
Well, I think we're happy about it. We're happy that if Linus finds that using Fedora is a good way to get his job done, then yeah, absolutely, we're happy about it. I mean, I don't think that's one of the things that we say, you know, immediately that has some extreme bearing as opposed to any other random user who might choose us over another distribution. You know, Linus happens to use us because it works for him, and that's great. And I'm sure that if we stopped working for him, you know, he would totally feel free to change distributions. And, you know, it's not something that that we necessarily hang our hat on. And, you know, I can't say that, like, I called him every month or two and make sure he's happy, you know, a satisfied customer. You know, I don't do that. I'm very happy that he uses it, and you know, I hope that we'll continue to be a part of his life. I'm glad that we've, you know, been able to help him in some small way, because, you know, as we all know, he's helped all of us for years. You know, he's made millions of people happy with his operating system. And, you know, if he chooses to use Fedora for that, I think that's great, but it's, you know, it's not something that I generally go out and I don't make that a big talking point, because, you know, Linus, like anyone else, is certainly, you know, free to change their operating system. If they like running free software, they can change it as often as they, you know, change their clothes. And that's one of the great things about free software, is it gives you that option. You're not locked in.
That is true. Now, how long is your position? I mean, how long do you plan on keeping your position? Is that something that expires and you pass it on to somebody else, or do you keep it as long as you want it?
Yeah, well, pretty much until they pry the keys to our orbital laser from my cold dead hands. That's long. Yeah, they'll have to rip the crown off my moldering head. It's something I've been doing now for 9 months, and I feel like I'm just starting to get a handle on all of the things that need to be done in this job. There's a great staff of people I have to work with, and we all collaborate constantly, and make sure that, we're not leaving any balls that are in the air to fall and sort of smash on the ground. You know, we watch each other's backs, and that way I know that if I miss something at the end of the day, that somebody either A is going to let me know, or B will handle it and then tell me about it later, and so I can take care of it the next time around. This is a very different job from the job that I used to do, which was I was a public servant. And, I feel like I was a pretty engaged public servant. I actually really cared about my job and doing right by taxpayers and doing good. And this job, in one way, it's very similar, right? Because I feel like I'm doing a great public good. I feel like I'm doing something that benefits, you know, millions of people worldwide, even people, you know, and I'll never meet people who live in other countries. But it's something that's very important to a lot of people for a lot of different reasons. So I have that sense of achievement. And at the same time, it's also very different because, you know, at the end of the day, I am an employee in a stockholder-owned company. And, you know, we're accountable to people other than, just my friends who work in Fedora. So always trying to keep both of those things in mind and make sure that we always are doing completely right by the community and staying open and transparent in Fedora, and at the same time using those values and using those objectives to increase the value of Red Hat as a business enterprise. It's a very challenging job, and I feel like I'm still getting to know some parts of it. And, I'll probably look around and, you know, at some, you know, some random time from, well, not random, but, essentially some future point and probably know that I've gotten the barriers that I really wanted to remove, that I've gotten them out of the way. And if I get to that point and I find that I can't identify the next one and I don't know where to look for it, that's probably the time that I need to start looking for somebody else who's got a new and different vision, right? Somebody who takes Fedora to the next level. And I think that's something that Max did when he looked to me. I think he found the things that he wanted to do, achieved them, and then said, you know what? I feel like I've achieved what I set out to do, and now it's time for somebody else to identify new things to do. And at some point, I'm going to feel that way too. And I don't know at this point when that'll be. I can't see myself doing this job for, say, you know, if Fedora will last for a very long time, and, you know, I can't see myself being in this job, say, you know, 5 or 10 years from now. I think that would be bad for the project as a whole. And I think we do need to have turnover in the leadership, because it brings people in with a clear, you know, a new vision, change of blood, you know, it gets people energized and shows people that that things do move on from time to time. And, you know, I'm lucky to have this position because I started in the community and have become an integral part of Red Hat, I would hope. And by the same token, you know, Max started as somebody who was integral at Red Hat and was unknown to the community when he took over as the Fedora project leader. So we're kind of two sides of the same coin, and it's really nice being able to still work with Max. I'm really glad that he's still at Red Hat, and we talk all the time. And I think this is something that, you know, in the future I will be able to offer to other project leaders. You know, I'll be able to come in and say, you know, here are some of the things that you might want to think about. Here are some of the things that vexed me, or here's some of the things that I found were very successful strategies, and those are the same kind of things that Max has shared with me. And I think it's kind of like the old ex president's club or something like that, you know, where we sort of pass on the little bit of wisdom that we hopefully accumulate over months and years, and give that to somebody else to help them lead.
Sounds like you're having a lot of fun though, and that's the best thing, huh?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I you know, and like I said before, I'm every day I wake up, and even if I know yesterday was a hard day, or I know today is going to be a hard day, or I have, you know, something that I'm not looking forward to, I still think, man, I'm so happy to get up in the morning and be working for Red Hat. I'm so happy to be working for the cause of free software and doing something that I really care passionately about. I mean, every single day, it is just the greatest feeling in the world. And it doesn't hurt either that I don't have to commute anymore. Right now I'm sort of working out of my house, so, you know, I roll out of bed, you know, get cleaned up, and come down, pour my coffee, and go down into my basement, into my cave. And I got a little office down here and studio, and I just get right to work, and it's great. It's, you know, I kind of get to do my part to save the planet too, right, because I'm not burning fossil fuels or whatever. I don't know if that stuff's important to you, but... You know, it's always fun to mention that to people that I, you know, don't really commute to do this job. Like, my commuting is all over the internet. You know, instantly I'm connected to people all around the world, and you know, I sit down at 6:45 in the morning, and you know, people are on that I know from like Greece and Australia, and I get about an hour or so to chat with a few of them before they start dropping offline. And by the time I go to bed, the Australians are coming back online. So you know, we have this community that just spans the globe, and it's amazing to see how things move during the entire day. And when I sign on at night or sign on in the morning, you know, I see what's happened the night before, and I'm just constantly amazed at how this process worked. So yeah, I mean, it's a great job. It's one of the greatest jobs in the world. It's also one of the hardest jobs in the world, at least one of the hardest ones I can imagine, you know, next to you know, a job like, say, Jim Whitehurst, right, the CEO of Red Hat. I'm sure that he has a harder job than I do, but it is, you know, both of them are challenging in their own way, and you know, I really enjoy this, so I can't think of being anywhere else right now.
That's awesome, man. I'm envious.
Paul, we have a question from our IRC that a fellow in the Netherlands is just dying for us to ask you. He wants to know about the new kernel mode setting features in Fedora 10 and the features associated with Plymouth Gizmo.
Ooh, tech talk. Awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
See, we're going to hit you.
So let me talk a little bit about that. I feel like I've, like, monopolized you guys' whole show. I'm looking at the time, and I'm like, holy mother God, how long have I been talking? Like, way too long.
Doesn't matter. You just keep going. That's how,
right,
that's
right.
That's how we do it. We just let – that's how we do it for so long.
We
just let the guests go, and you can talk as much as you want, and we don't have to do a thing.
All right. And what's so funny for the listeners – what's funny for the listeners out there is I was emailing with, I think, Pat earlier, and I was like, so, you know, how long do you want me there? And he's like, oh, yeah, well, you know, you can do about this long, but, you know, it depends. And I was saying, okay, cool, because I looked at that time, and I'm like, yeah, I'm thinking, yeah, that'll be perfect. And here I am, like, you know, completely overshot the whole thing. It's hilarious. So, yeah, so let's talk about Plymouth and kernel mode setting. Plymouth is a new bootloader that is designed to take advantage of the kernel mode setting feature that allows the kernel basically to set up a somewhat of a kind of a frame buffer before we get to the actual full desktop display manager, whatever that might be. By using the kernel mode setting instead of what we used to use, we save a lot of boot time. What a lot of distributions still use, not necessarily our particular graphical boot engine, but a lot of distributions use a graphical boot engine, and what they're doing essentially after you start the kernel up and do a couple other quick things, you then basically start a minimal version of the X window system, right? And that's the GUI that sort of underlies whatever you're using, whether it's, you know, whether you're using GNOME or KDE or whatever. Underneath all that is X. And so what happens when you start X is you've got to read a huge number of files off disk, and there's all sorts of things you have to open just to get to the point where you can show a progress bar to the user, right, and tell them how far they're going to get in the booting, which you just slowed down. So a couple of the desktop hackers in Red Hat were looking at this. They've been looking at this for a while now and thinking, you know, this is just not cool. And a guy by the name of, and I'm gonna horribly mangle his name, and so I apologize if he's out there, Christian Hugesberg, did a demo about a year and a half ago, where he was showing off this kernel mode setting feature and what you could use it for. And so one of our guys, another guy by the name of Adam Jackson, or he goes by AJacksonIRC, and he's a longtime ex-hacker, and he kind of looked at this and said, you know, I think we can take this to the next level and use this as a way to sort of bootstrap people to the full display manager. It's not going to be as jarring because we're not going to end up turning X on and off, your monitor won't flash as much, and you know, there's a lot of things to be gained, but not the least of which is if we don't have to start X, a whole X session just for the pleasure of showing you a progress bar, if we do it some other way by using the kernel instead, you're going to shave off a huge amount of time. So, well, maybe not huge, but I mean, it is substantial, and it's definitely, you know, goes a long way on the road to this, you know, the mythical, you know, 5-second boot time or whatever the case may be. So, kernel mode setting, will work right now. I believe the kernel mode setting feature for Plymouth will work on a lot of newer ATI cards automatically. I know it doesn't work on NVIDIA, and it would have worked on Intel, except something changed. Intel changed something about their driver subsystem, like really close to our preview release or our final release, so there was no way to make the appropriate code changes and get them all tested in any meaningful way before the release. So this will happen automatically just for this kind of smaller set of ATI cards, but we're still working on the feature, and you'll probably see a lot more coverage for Fedora 11. But that doesn't stop you, and, you know, and I've been told that this, for some people, this will actually break booting. For some people, it will not. So if you want to try it out, if you're game to, when you get your Fedora 10 bucks, if you don't get the pretty graphical boot screen, reboot, and add to your grub configuration. You can do this at boot time, right? You hold down the control key as you're booting, and that will bring up your grub screen. And go down and locate the kernel line and hit, I think it's E to edit, and then look for the line that says kernel, and there's a bunch of version information, and then hit E to edit that line in particular. And at the end of that, you can add this. You can add VGA equals 0x317, and that's basically setting a kernel. You're setting a video mode for the kernel that will allow it to fake a device that lets it show the real pretty graphical boot screen. Now, again, I want to warn you, that's not going to work for everybody. For some people, it means that booting will simply fail. So don't consider that safe. That's not like official project advice. But I can tell you that I've got two machines here. I got one of them is an Intel machine. The other one, oh, I've forgotten what's in it. It may be ATI or maybe an NVIDIA. And it worked on them. So you can give it a try, and if it works, great. You'll get to see the beautiful boot in all its glory. And what will happen is immediately after your system starts booting, rather than seeing a bunch of text messages and little penguins and then having to wait a while before you get a graphical screen, and then you have to transition from that graphical screen to another one, here's what will happen. You'll start up, and immediately you'll see the Fedora boot screen, and it'll be this blue sun, this solar sun, and flares shooting out of it, and a comet flying around it, and a kind of a fuzzy progress bar in the middle of the screen that goes forward as you're booting. And then you'll transition to the display manager. Now, if you're using the sort of the poor man's technique that I just described, you won't get what is one of the other really cool features of Plymouth, which is that the boot screen on these newer ATI cards that I talked about before, right, the ones that are right now are actually fully working with Plymouth, you get this fade, like a smooth crossfade from the progress screen to your display manager. There's no, like, flicker, your monitor goes off and comes on. There's none of that stuff. Just goes smoothly from one to the next. And eventually, we're going to have that for a lot more cards than we have now. I don't know if it'll be the majority of all cards out there, but it will be quite a lot of them. Now, if you don't go through any of this, and I'm sorry to belabor the point, but I want to make sure people know what they'll be in for. If you don't see the graphical screen, what you'll get is basically a simple text-based screen with a progress bar at bottom. So even if you can't use, the beautiful solar screen, you'll still have a progress tracker. It'll just basically be a blue and white bar at the bottom of your screen, and you'll still get faster boot. So even if you don't get the beautiful stuff, you still get the side effect of a faster boot regardless. And so hopefully we'll have the hot shininess will be there, for more people for Fedora 11.
Cool. That's pretty cool. That is sweet. That is sweet.
Yeah, it's really wicked to see it. When you see these, this animation, this flares shooting out and stuff, it's like, it's incredibly crazy. I had a guy who emailed me, he's one of my buddies in Red Hat who works on, he does like videography and stuff like that. And he emailed me today out of the blue and just said, I just booted Fedora 10 on my, he happened to have a system with one of these ATI cards in it. So he emailed me, I just booted this thing. Dear God, that's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And I just cracked up laughing because, I think people don't really know what they're in for. When they see that, they're going to, it's one of those little eye candy things that people really respond to. And the people who don't get it, who don't get the graphical boot, I have a feeling some of them are going to be disappointed, and we do feel that, like, we're not trying to ignore that or say we're not going to worry about you anymore. If you want it, get a newer video card. We really are working to extend this to more video cards, but the real payoff is not necessarily the shiny new hotness. It's really the boot process. It's all about speeding up the boot for everybody. So no matter what, you're going to get that.
Speed up the boot process with Splashtop, huh?
With Splashtop? What was that? I missed it.
Yeah, Splashtop. Haven't you heard of Splashtop, the Linux boot technology off the ROM chip on the motherboard?
The one that kind of gets you from bare metal up to Linux in like no time flat. Yeah. So it's funny because it's funny you mention that, because I think where a lot of people are going with that, maybe not quite the same strategy, but virtualization being everywhere, people are going to embed virtualization and firmware eventually. You can build a pretty slim virtual host. Nowadays, especially with chip memory, on die memory increasing the way it does, people are going to be able to build some pretty snazzy virtualization hosts, right on the bare metal, and so you'll basically have like an instant on computer, right? That's really the future.
But I think it's really hysterical about that whole Splashtop thing. Is like, I started using computers with my VIC-20, and it's come full circle now. You know what I mean? It started out with computers where you powered it on, and the operating system was in ROM. And they moved off of that to huge, big operating systems that took, you know, 20 minutes to load, and now they're going back to ROM again.
Yeah, yeah. And, it, you know, I think people have said the same funny thing about, like, you know, Sun saying 20 years ago or whatever, the network is the computer, right? And people poo-pooed it, and for 20 years, you know, we've spent kind of chasing around the other way, only to go, you know, all the way around the world to where, you know, people now are talking about, you know, you using the cloud and network services, and, you know, so they were eventually right. It's just all of the strategy in the middle that, you know, didn't really work for them. So, but, you know, there are ideas, and then there are ideas, right? And, you know, and sometimes their time doesn't get there when you think it does. So, yeah, I mean, it's really funny to see the way things come around like that.
With all this innovation and all these neat things coming out from, you know, embedded devices and, you know, the very simple monitoring systems through handheld devices and tablets, through netbooks, to the standard desktop systems, all the way up to mainframes and virtual computing and clusters. I mean, Linux runs on it all, and it just, it almost seems like we're on the cusp of an explosion into the general population with all these devices. Does it ever get frustrating to you? That it has not achieved a lot more adoption?
I don't know. It's one of those things. I think people have been saying that for a long time. Like, you know, the joke is that every year, you know, people say, oh, it's the year of the Linux desktop, right? And that's been like every year for the last, I don't know how many years. You know, for me and my house, every year is the year of the Linux desktop because, you know, I use it constantly here and I never have any complaints. You know, and the same goes for, you know, my wife sits down at the computer and she's the same way. She's like, I'm so happy. You know, she tells me this every couple months, like, you know, without me twisting her arm or anything like that. You know, she says, man, I'm so glad that I don't have to waste time. Like, you know, our friends across the street, you know, they were cleaning their computer for 2 hours on Sunday and me, I just sit down and use it. You know, I just use the darn thing, do what I need to do. You know, that it is true that Linux is pervasive, right? I mean, it's one of the things that is so amazing about kernel and about the whole model of open source development is that it is possible to take into account a lot of disparate needs and handle them extremely well. And, you know, a lot of the credit for that, I mean, goes to the people who designed and worked on it for so long. I mean, from Linus on down, you know, these guys knew what they wanted. They wanted a kernel that works. And, you know, they have attracted the right people to make sure that what works well in one place works very, very well in another place, too, and on down the line. You know, I think the thing that we have going for us now, that Linux has going for us now, is that we've got, you know, we really have a really solidly growing mind share worldwide. There are because one of the next big obstacles to tackle over the next, I don't know, decade or more is bridging the digital divide, right? Making sure that people everywhere have the access to information that they need to become to become sustaining economies, right? You want countries to be able to feed their populace efficiently, you know, and have them be global partners, right? Because of that, the need for open standards is going to grow as well. I mean, it already is in a lot of senses. I mean, we've already seen this. It's already working in Europe and places like India and China. And, you know, people are clamoring for open standards because they don't want to have that access to information guarded or you know, they don't want to have a gatekeeper that's a singular entity. They would much rather trust in a community of people scattered around the world who have no, you know, there's no global agenda for Linux other than world domination, right? So, that means that we can provide equal access to information for everybody. We provide adherence to open standards, and we're doing it right, making sure that everyone has that access to information. And so, you know, I think in one sense, I think we are on the cusp of something great, but I think that we've been that way for a long time. Like, I think that we're, it's more that we're on a steady upward trajectory, and we have been for some time. And, you know, maybe the pace is getting a little faster. I would like to think so. Certainly the mind share has been now, and more people are aware of what open source offers. And, you know, I think in the future that, you know, there's nothing but things.
What the heck? Hello?
There's apparently an angry cloud of bees that really disagrees.
What the heck was that?
That sounds Mac.
I'm sorry about that. Wow. Anyway, you were saying? You can finish your thought?
I got to the end of my thought.
Okay, good. Before the Africanized honeybees attacked. Damn.
They were mad.
Yeah. That was the Redmond bees. They didn't like what you were saying.
the genetically engineered attack squadron, right? They're here to wipe out all of the software freedom hippies, right? Make sure that they're not spreading that joy and love to everybody. We don't like it.
Right.
That's awesome. You know, it's just been really great talking to you. And having you on, it's been really enthusiastic. I mean, the Fedora project is just, it's great, and they do a lot. You know, not only Fedora, but Red Hat, and there's just everything.
Yeah, Red Hat should get a lot of kudos for what they've done.
Great for the community.
Yeah, I think, you know, the company's done really, they've done really great work, and, you know, I think when they got the idea of really partnering solidly with the community, I mean, things have just taken off like gangbusters from there. You know, we had our first few years a little bit rocky as we're trying to figure it out, and I think that's one of the things that we've always tried to do in Fedora is, you know, don't be afraid to try because of failure. It's okay to fail, but you got to pick yourself up right away, figure out what you did wrong, fix it, and keep going all the time. And, you know, it's that kind of, you know, it's that release early, release often mentality, right? Maybe maybe each release isn't a gangbuster, and I'm talking here not about the Fedora distribution of Linux, but, you know, about the way that you work, the way you work with a community. You know, maybe every single time you're doing it, it's not perfect, but you always try and look at it and say, what can we learn from what we just did? What were the successes? What were the failures? What can we take away from that? And how do we use it to do better?
Coolness.
Kind of like life.
Well, Paul, I thank you. I'm not kicking you off, but
for having me on.
Yeah, but before we cut out of here, because we usually close up around 10:30, we have to let somebody who's been begging to come on and say something for a little while. You're more than welcome to stay on. Maybe he's got relevant information for you. But JZA, you're there? Maybe not. But, Paul, I want to thank you.
He may have turned into an angry cloud of bees.
Maybe that's who they attacked.
That's possible, yeah.
There he is. Oh, here they come.
It's awesome internet connection.
Is that you, JZA?
Yep, that's it.
Yeah, you got to turn off your mic boost, I think. You're killing Paul.
I'm okay. I'm just now I know I can sleep at night. Now that I know what it is. I was gonna leave my office here and like head out with one of those beekeeper bonnets and a big can of Raid and find out what was going on here.
Damn, are you a big fan of Open Office, Paul?
I use it quite a bit myself. I mean, it's not the only thing I use. I usually use it when I've got to make something that's for somebody who is not as much of a techie but who's on a Linux platform, right, and I need to make something for them to edit. I mean, I usually jump back and forth between, like, that and Emacs and, you know, and sometimes gedit, I guess. I sometimes use that, too.
So what's your, you know, and maybe not just yours, but, I mean, last week was it Jonathan Swartz in his blog had proposed the idea that he thinks is good to put ads into OpenOffice. Ads.
Yeah, they were going to like sell branding space or something like that, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
I don't get that.
You know, I mean, I guess it's something you can do when your product's in front of a lot of people. Fortunately, our packaging in Fedora, we kind of split out the branding part into a different sub-package, and we do that so that people can separately brand it if they need to. So it's not probably going to matter to a lot of people. You know, I'm not saying that we would necessarily strip that out at all. I'm just saying that, there's a lot of different ways you can go. I mean, it is still, at the end of the day, it's open source software, and, we'd probably look at that and just see what, you know, what the terms were around it, make sure that we're comfortable with them before we would take any sort of action or look at how the branding is being done. I mean, I'm sure they are well aware of the open source people who provide millions of users of that software and are providing a lot of the development for it too. And they're aware of the people out there. And I would probably just withhold judgment until I see what it is they're going to do. And that's about the size of it. I do think that everybody should go check out there's a YouTube video somewhere that I saw about open source ponytail, and go Google that and you'll find something funny. I was rolling. This is actually connected to Jonathan Swartz, so you got to go watch
it. Open source ponytail, right?
Just look for open source ponytail.
Yeah, I don't know. I just don't get the whole ads and stuff, because all we ever hear about are people are sick and tired of ads, sick and tired of ads, sick and tired of ads, always finding technology to remove ads and bypass ads and, in browsers and everything else. And then the big idea that he wants to come out with is to put ads in OpenOffice. And I just don't get it. I mean, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know what that says from I don't know what that says from a strategic point of view. I'm not. On the other hand, I'm not running a global enterprise level IT provider. So it'd be easy for me to second guess what they're doing. But I don't know how much value is in it. I personally don't see what the good is in that. I think the ways that you develop community, it's not about putting a brand in front of people. I think it's really about making the brand stand for something. And this is one of the reasons why, I'm really excited and happy to be working for Red Hat, because, I think if there's any company that is synonymous with free software and open source, it's got to be Red Hat. I mean, they've done a huge amount for the field, and they've elevated the visibility of it, and they continue to provide huge amount of development and features and so forth. And I always thought that before I was ever an employee, and since I've gotten there, my respect hasn't changed. I think if anything, it's gotten greater, because I get to meet more people every day or every month that are part of the company, and just find out what the real attitude is inside the company for the open source community. And it's all good. People are just so passionate about what is happening in the free software community worldwide, and just to see that at work every day, it just really makes you happy to be part of that team.
That's cool. So, are you a GNOME guy or a KDE guy?
I'm a GNOME guy myself. I used to go back and forth a little bit just for giggles, and I try a lot of the different things out. But I've kind of settled into a routine now, and I think KDE is really cool because it's extremely tweakable, right? I mean, down to really low level stuff, and for a lot of people that is where it's at. And I'm very happy that people have that choice. For myself, I'm I'm really looking at it as from the perspective of somebody who's a productivity user, where I need the desktop to simply, when I unpack it, I just want everything to work. I don't want to spend a huge amount of time tweaking it. I really want to just get to my work. Especially since I'm spending all day, every day in Linux, and some of those desktop technologies are part of my life every day. You know, so I'm using Network Manager every day. I'm using things like, some of the GNOME applets, right? And things like, Pulse Audio and Power Management and all the way those things work. And, I really just want them to kind of do their thing and not bug me a lot. And I don't want to spend a lot of time tweaking, so I end up being a GNOME guy. But there are, we've got people who run the entire gamut. There are people I've met who are, XFCE or LXDE guys. I've even met a few people who are like, all you guys are lamers. TWM, if you can't run that, you're not a real Linux guy. Or some people are like, if you even turn on X, you're not a real Linux hacker. And so, you find a real broad range of personalities and what they like to use.
Sweet. Gentlemen, any questions you have to ask?
Nope.
Keep up the good work, man.
Well, thanks a lot, guys. I really appreciate you having me on, and I'm sorry to take all your time tonight, but I'm glad we had a good chat.
No, don't apologize. It's been great. We really enjoyed it.
Well, you guys are super, and keep up the good work, and I'll keep listening.
Take care.
Take care, guys.
Thanks a lot, man. Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
I'm trying to get an announcement. Go ahead, announce.
Our friends from A-Press have released a book for free download. It's called The Definitive Guide to Linux Network Programming. I'm going to put the link in the IRC. Download away, people.
Good book. Check it out.
Definitive Guide to what?
To Linux Network Programming.
What's the programming in what language?
I don't know.
You gotta download and check, read the book, yeah. It's free. Link, you had something too, didn't you?
The Neuros release. But Dan's gonna play the audio clip for that, right, Dan? Hello, Dan. Where's the Dan?
Hey, what's going on?
Hey, what's up, Chase here?
I'm doing all right.
It's about damn time.
Yeah.
Chase, yeah, are they putting ads on your forehead?
Well, here's the thing. It seems that most people start, bashing, and they don't even read the blog post. But I'll give it to you. This one is actually controversial. We actually had a big thread up in the mailing list in OpenOffice. The thing is that what Schwartz was talking about is that Java, since I think 1.6 when it was released, it embedded a OpenOffice banner on the installer. And the point was that because Java is basically widely massified, it created a big surge on our downloads on OpenOffice. So a lot of people got to know OpenOffice through the Java installer, and that was the advertising spot that he was talking about. Now, the thing is that OpenOffice 3.0 got released and it generated around 10 million downloads in a month's time. So what he was talking about was maybe we can leverage on the distribution that we're gaining from this huge number of downloads software, and we can provide advertising. Now, he never really specified advertising out of what. So, for example, I think his point was maybe OpenOffice can bring the other open source project that we're working. For example, let's say VirtualBox or the one with the fish, Glassfish, I think, is the is the one that they're trying to push right now. So basically, it's a little bit different to saying like what you're going to see in Opera that had an embedded banner up in the top of the software. It's more about like having non-critical advertising, like the installer, for example.
Oh, that explains some stuff. But sure enough, you didn't want to come on today and discuss OpenOffice ads. I assume you had, because you've been wanting to come on and say something for a little while now. What is it? Bless you.
Thank you. Right, so I don't hear you real well. I'm going to have to do something on magic here. All right, so what I was trying to say the last time is that I just came back from Europe. I was talking about, I went to a conference to talk about OpenOffice up in Spain. The thing is that the thing in Spain is huge. I actually wasn't aware of it until I came to this event. This event has like 8,000 attendees and about 300 open source speakers up in one room. Well, one big building. The conference was pretty good. The organization was also awesome. But what it really was interesting is actually see that they are using OpenOffice across the whole government. That's around pretty much like 3 million computers using Linux across the government, either between education, healthcare, and even some, organizations inside the government, like the police, the bomber, fire department, etc.
So it was very, made you very happy?
Well, for sure. I mean, I guess many people here will make it better. Happy because it seems that we hear these huge migrations happen every other place, but to actually go there and see them, that everybody is running the technology and they're actually working on improving it, it really is a difference.
That is sweet.
Now, some of these governments, the way that they use it right now, it might not be applicable to the United States, basically because the way they go about it is basically they create a government-sponsored distribution, and then they claim or they build cases around identity. And you really need to know the background history of Spain to understand why they do it. Right now, there's a big push about trying to get sovereignty on the regions. So, for example, the region, before they speak Spanish, they used to speak some other language like Catalan. They play the part that they can localize the software and they can use that software across the board, and for that, pushing the, the regional language. So they make a political case about pushing regional identity, and they can get funded.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else you want to add? Because I actually have to get moving. Because there's a...
All right, yeah. That's basically what I was saying about this conference was pretty awesome, and I guess I want to give a small report about what happened over there.
We need to get you on at some point, maybe in the next couple of weeks, and you can, because OpenOffice 3.0 was just released, and who better to talk about it than you? Yes? Why not?
Sure.
So let me talk with you about getting you on in maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks, one of these shows in the upcoming weeks, okay?
Cool.
All right, so JZA, thank you for your update, and I will arrange with you to get back on the show in the next couple of weeks. Thumbs up, so long as you're not traveling around the world, We'll be cool with that. And, gentlemen, anything else?
That's it. Just, you're going to play the Neuros announcement, right?
Oh, yeah. Thank you for reminding me. Yeah, I'm going to...
Yes, yes.
I'm going to play that. Hold on.
Very cool new product from Neuros today. Was just launched today, and Joe from Neuros was kind enough to send us a little audio clip talking about that. While the audio clip is playing, if you are interested, you can find out more about the the new product at, I believe the address is neuros.tv.
We'll it's also on there. Their main website, too, I think.
I'm sure it is at this point, yeah.
Hold on, let me
yeah, neuros.tv does take there.
Neuros is a great company, Neuros Technology. You know, Joe Bourne, he gets it. Absolutely
oh, yeah.
support them.
Oh, yeah.
Great
they're
stuff.
One of the, and they're right up there in my my very top companies list, you know. Especially for open store stuff, they're really on the ball, and they have great stuff. You know what I mean? It's not even like it's I'm supporting it because it's open source, but it's junky stuff. It's damn fantastic stuff there. Fantastic stuff. The stuff works like they say it does. You get it at a really good price. Constantly, you know, you get all the best things about open source. Like you get people who are constantly adding new features and upgrades and stuff like that. You just can't go wrong, right? So while you listen to this, go on and head over to neuros.tv. That's neuros.tv in your web browser. And listen to Joe as he talks about the brand new Neuros Link that was just released today.
All right, well, we're going to kick that audio off, and following that is a song by Mabel Lynch. It's Jazz Tonight, called The Man For Me, dedicated to Dave Yates. And I want to thank everybody, and we'll see you all next week. Who's our guest for next week?
Except for me. I won't be here next week. I'll be in en route to upstate New York.
You suck.
Yeah.
Do we have a guest? Like we do have a guest for next week, don't we?
Yeah, we got Dave Kaplan coming back to give us an update on Lindependence up in Portland.
Okay.
Right. So Monster B can shut up now.
There we go.
He thinks the Lindependence is a whole scam because they never report back.
All right, well, be that as it may, here we go with Joe Bourne from Neuros. And Mabel Lynch. So see you next week.
Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you so much for having me on and tell your listeners about a new product we've got. It's called the Neuros Link. And what it does is links Internet TV, brings Internet TV to the TV set. So I'm talking about all the web content from NBC.com to Hulu and YouTube and the like, all that stuff brought directly to the TV set. It's also phenomenal at playing back all kinds of downloaded content from virtually any source in all kinds of different formats, and H.264 and MKV containers and all kinds of stuff, up to 1080p resolution, so full high def. It's all powered by the Neuros TV, Neuros.tv service, which is basically an aggregator, a community-based tool that allows you to search and eventually we have more kind of community functionality for all kinds of video stuff. But it provides kind of the interface and the search and browsing interface to the device. And it's really something we're terrifically excited about. It's kind of a category creator in that it really goes in that gap between, you know, all the dedicated proprietary devices from, you know, Apple TV and D-Link and Netgear and HP and the like, for, you know, the digital media adapter category, if you will, for bringing content of various types, but, you know, a small selection to the TV set, And on the other extreme, you've got, you know, just connecting a PC to the TV, but, you know, it's noisy and more expensive and doesn't provide that kind of consumer electronics interface. So it's really, you know, it's really kind of a new category. And, you know, we hear things like, oh, you know, sounds like the Holy Grail, and, you know, there's skepticism how we could do it. And I think, you know, all that disbelief, to me, is our best evidence of why this is really, why the open electronics approach is really so compelling, because that's really the secret behind this, that we, you know, people ask, how'd you get all that content on your device? We didn't. We just adopted those open standards from Flash and using browsers would take plugins and all this, you know, huge body of open source software, and it really yields something very, very powerful. You know, I think it's safe to call it the most powerful piece of electronics that you might have. But let your viewers see for themselves. They can go to www.neurostv to check it out, and certainly hope they do. Thanks again very much for letting me tell your listeners about it.
I've been waiting a long time for Mr. Wright. Are you the man for me? I really want to know. Are you the man that I'll adore? Are you the man I've been longing for? I want to know.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up. It's over.
Yeah. That's it. I'm gonna shut it off now. Thank you all for listening. What?
I said, have a good one.
Yeah, you too, man. You too. I'll talk to you guys later.
Bye.
Chad, 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 Chad Wallenberg, Wallenberg, Chad, sexy Dave Yates presents Chad Wallenberg, Ross Werner, and a Linux all-out extravaganza, the techie geek lot of basement love.
Oh, and I was running D-Message, and I kept looking at that on it, and it just, it says that it recognizes the device, but it doesn't actually recognize the device. What it is, it just says something's been plugged in. And looking on the boards for the Aspire on it, it seems like I have to recompile also in order to get the support for it. And I just didn't feel like doing that yet. But I'm going to play around. Well, you know. So it's distorted, huh?
No, it's a little static.
Oh, okay. Huh. Because I was talking on the phone and everybody was saying it was alright, so I was wondering what's different. Well, I don't talk a whole lot anyways, and I don't. It's late now, and I don't feel like plugging in all my other stuff, so we're stuck with it.
Can you mute yourself?
I'll let you know and just... Oh, I'm back again.
Yeah, you did it. It muted.
Okay, cool.
You might want to mute yourself because there's a little bit of static coming through.
Is it static or is it the music in the background?
It might be a little bit of both.
I'm in the lounge music all of a sudden. I don't know why. I'm like hooked on a Soma FM, the lounge tracks on there.
Are you hooked on a dream?
No, what is actually playing now? So Nice Summer Samba by Astrud Gilberto and Walter Wunderlich. I don't know why all of a sudden like I'm like listening to this all the time.
Are you old?
No, it's not that. It just, I don't know. It's neat sounding. What can I say? It's good background music, actually. Thanks for setting up the other number here for me.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to go delete that right now. Hold on. Hey, no problem. Anytime. Sorry it took me a day and a half to do it, or 2 days, or whatever it did. I saw your email, and I'm like, I'll take care of that, and then I forgot.
Not a problem.
And I'm like, oh, that's Alan wanted that. And then I'm like, I'll just take care of it later. And I'm like, no, I better do it now because I'm not going to do it later.
But now to call the other line, it's just we just dialed my other extension, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I have to try. Actually, I haven't even tried that. I've made some outgoing calls with it just for, you know, the hell of it. But
who are you going to call?
Pretty much right now, just the wife is all.
No. Who are you going to call?
Ghostbusters, of course.
Something strange in Gorkon's neighborhood. Who are you going to call?
Ghostbusters.
Something smells funny in Dave Yates Honda. Who are you going to call?
Ghostbusters. What you gotta do is like is put a collection of all your songs together.
There we go, huh?
Release it at the next Ohio Linux Fest. The Sweet Warblings of Dan Wasco.
Sweet
Warblings.
Finally, I got to crack open this Neuros OSD. Look at that.
Cool.
It was like Christmas here today. I got a new router. A Linksys WR54. Wait, what is it?
Did you get the GL version?
Yes. WR54GL. So I can play around.
I got to order one of those.
Open WRC
property.
I was setting it up. You know, you go in and you set it up for your network and you change the passwords and everything. And I kept doing it and I couldn't log into it afterwards. And I'm like, what the hell? Because I set it to a static IP and then I turn off the HTTP server. And everything was working fine, but every time I did it, I couldn't log back into it. It wouldn't connect. And it turns out I was setting the IP address in the wrong place.
Oops. Well, I had that today. I just fixed it tonight. I upgraded finally the desktop to 8.10, and I was running a web server on 8081 because, you know, RCM won't let you do one on 80, and it wouldn't work. It kept saying it couldn't find the stuff and it couldn't find my files. I'm like, damn, the damn thing just worked anyways. And here they changed the config file on me.
Yeah, I
kept setting the port back up because I blew away Apache 2. You know, I uninstalled it and then I reinstalled it, so it came back on port 80, and I was like, okay, I can find it now. On it, went to change the port config to 8081, and it's like, you can't find anything again. And here you have to enable it under the site enable directory as well. But that was neat.
I need to move to my other chair. It's like bunny shit all over.
Yeah. You just let the bunny go all around?
Yeah, but he's been pretty good about crapping in his litter box. Sometimes you find little nuggets. I don't think he's got too much control over the pooper. He just runs and poops.
Yeah, I think that's just generally rabbits just run and poop at the same time.
And hump. You like that too.
Because he likes you, Dan. Get a little bunny love going there. Remember my password on the Aspire board. Isn't that shocking? So who is our guest for tonight? I really haven't had a chance this week to look.
I was supposed to be talking to Paul Freel.
And like I said, I'm a little slow, so. Who would that be again?
What?
Who would that be again? As bad as that makes me sound.
Project lead at for Fedora.
Okay.
Ooh, an RI blast. Ha ha! I'm gonna put that back in the bottom.
What do you got over there?
I got a Neuros OSD. I won it in that competition.
Oh, really? Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, like, what, two or three people posted comments and suggestions about it, and they pulled my hat. Mine was a winner.
Oh, that's cool. Congratulations.
Yeah. I'm psyched. Hello.
Hello.
How you doing?
Hey, what's up, man?
You're not Paul.
No, I'm not.
You're not Link.
No, I'm not. I'm Pat.
Where are you? Are you calling in from home?
Yeah, I am.
Oh, okay.
Who's standing next to the waterfall?
That's Alan.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Is that you, Paul? Is that you, Link? Is that Link?
Uh-huh. Link's on speakerphone.
I can't hear him. Can you hear him?
It's not terrible, man. It's something really noisy.
Alan, mute yourself.
There you go. Must be his Apple machine.
You know, I just can't. No, no, it's my Spire. Yeah. I just can't win for trying here. Just can't win for
trying. Turn your volume. Do you have your mic boost on?
That's what I'm trying to go into now.
Something hello.
Noisy.
How about now? Anything?
Sounds horrible. Wow.
No, there's like this massive static.
Yeah, it sounds like you're standing next to like a waterfall in Hawaii.
There you go. What'd you do?
That's clear. Wait.
I heard somebody else come in.
I turned off the mic.
Mic there, so that's why you couldn't hear me.
Yeah, sounds like complete ass.
How about now?
That's better, like, but can you turn yourself up? Can you turn your mic up without turning the mic boost on?
That's what I'm trying to do. Anything now?
It's a little better.
Back the way it was before.
I don't hear as much static.
All right, how about now?
That's
a little better.
Okay.
There's not as much static. Who's dying over there?
That's me, man. If I drop off, it's because I'm coughing my brains up, so I'll hit the new button. Yeah, I'm still sick from last week, man. I still haven't got over it.
Sick on top? Oh, man, I'm sorry to hear about your mother-in-law, man.
Thank you.
That's a suck thing, dude. I'm sorry about that, too,
Yeah, I appreciate all the, warm wishes and thoughts from everybody.
Yeah, thoughts
are weird. I've had enough losses for this week for myself, too,
Yes.
I must have come in late to this part. Somebody lost a mother-in-law?
No,
yeah,
my
mother. Hi, Paul. This is Pat. Yeah, my mother-in-law passed away this week.
I'm sorry to hear that, man. You have my sympathies.
Thank you.
Paul, can you hear us okay?
I can hear you guys great, yeah.
Okay, awesome. Are we ready to start the show then?
Now, wait a second. Did the rain go away over here?
And so did your volume.
Obviously, this my idea is not going to work tonight. So
you know what?
Sounds like crap, Alan.
Alan, are you connected into the microphone through the AV cable?
Yeah, sadly I am. I'm going to have to.
You know what? I ran into the exact same problem with my Triple E. We were having it was pulling some nasty feedback or static. That's why I had to go USB.
All right, I guess I'm going to have to do that. But I'll just mute until I have to talk, so.
All right, so, Paul, have you ever listened to our show before?
Yeah, I have from time to time.
All right.
Don't lie.
So just so you know, we are streaming live right now. We didn't start the show yet. You're being recorded. We don't place any restrictions on the guests, and, just feel free to be yourself.
Does that include when I bring Charo out later for a little song and dance number? Is that cool?
I love Charo. Coochie
that's
coochie.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's fine by us.
For a 70-year-old man, she's hot.
Coochie coochie.
So what we're going to do is I'm going to play the show intro music, and then we'll say hello and probably get right into it, okay?
Sounds great.
All right, you guys ready?
Do it.
What about you, Staticky? Are you ready?